Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a look at new developments in the search for suspects in the European terror attacks. The U.S. Secretary of Defense travels to the Philippines. Live fast and die young seems to be one key to surviving extinction. And a new album is coming out for Fifth Harmony.
They say this album is going to be a little different for their fans than the first album was, in that it will be more R&B, more hip-hop oriented.
It's right here on The Voice of America. Belgian police continue their searches in connection with both the Brussels and Paris terrorist attacks. Correspondent Luis Ramirez joins us on the line to talk about the activity. Welcome, Luis.
Hi, Susan.
Say, how are things proceeding?
Well, almost daily we've been seeing raids. We've been seeing various operations going on in relation to both the Brussels and the Paris attacks. And, the latest is that three people who were detained in relation to one of those attacks that were detained on Tuesday were held for questioning regarding their involvement in the lease of a house where the attacks are believed to have been planned. That's in a suburb of Brussels called Uccle. They were held overnight until Wednesday. On Wednesday, the judge made a determination that there is not enough evidence for them to be charged, and so they have been released.
Are there concerns about the handling of detainees in this case?
There have been a number of questions on the part of citizens in Belgium and in France who have heavily criticized Belgian authorities for their lack of communication, for their lack of coordination, and for what is seen as an uncoordinated approach to investigating these attacks. The situation in Belgium is one in which you have a number of police agencies that security analysts say in some cases are not communicating with each other. But the justice minister and others in the government have repeatedly said now is not the time to be criticizing. It's time to carry out the investigations, find out what happened, and prevent it from happening again.
Is there any confidence that that is happening?
Certainly the fact that operations are underway and are happening daily is of some reassurance to people. But certainly when they're seeing suspects being arrested, being detained, questioned, and then released, that raises more questions as to whether it's happening competently or not. In any case, what people really want to see is for measures that will ensure that this does not happen again.
Has there been any talk about an international effort in Europe to help control the situation?
From the very beginning, interior ministers, others in the European Union put their heads together, started to have meetings to discuss how to support Belgium, both in the short term, that is, to aid in the investigations, to send personnel to offer advice, training, and also long term, perhaps a revamping of the security system in Belgium, given its very unique situation. They have the highest percentage, the highest ratio of foreign of fighters designated as foreign terrorist fighters living in Brussels alone. And so quite a big situation on their hands. And the question has been, How do these EU nations provide the assistance, both advisory, technical, and financial, to help Belgium revamp its security system?
Well, thank you very much, Luis.
Thank you, Susan.
And time for a look at what's going on the web today. And my colleague, social media reporter Andrew Palchewski, has joined us. And Andrew, you've been telling me that you have something about The ISIS people, Islamic State, today.
Yeah, related to this story out of Belgium, the Wall Street Journal has a report today that the Islamic State, as they're using social media to try to get their message out, the U.S. and other partners are shutting these accounts down, and the whole process is kind of sped up. Used to be it would take a couple days to try to find these accounts and shut them down. Now it's a matter of hours. And so they've adjusted their tactics. They're sending out tweets kind of right away, trying to get as maximum amount of time that they have, knowing that this account is going to be shut down in just a couple hours. And as they're opening these accounts, they're getting shut down within that short period of time by the U.S. government and others. And the process kind of reached a point where it's even in the sense that they open them, they get shut down, and they open more and they get shut down. They're kind of trying to keep pace with them. So it's kind of reached this stasis, if you will, where the amount of accounts that are being opened is roughly about the same as is being shut down.
I wonder if they'll ever get to the point where they'll monitor who is opening an account before they open an account. You know, so you just can't go out and open up an account if you feel like it. You have to apply first, and they say, oh, well, it's Andrew Palshevsky. He's okay. We'll let him have a Twitter account.
Hopefully I'm okay. It's, you know, they haven't stopped me yet. But no, it's, I think this is a big issue that people have raised as far as security. But then it brings in a lot of other issues, legal issues and free speech among them. People are saying, how can you restrict me from opening an account or look into my background and determine I'm worthy of opening an account but someone else isn't? I think generally across the board, people would like them to be stricter, certainly with people who are using it for terrorist purposes as ISIS is, but it wades into these issues that can be very sensitive. So something that's been proposed, we'll see if that's something that gets adopted by these companies. They've been working very well so far with the U.S. government. Twitter has been working with the government to try to shut these accounts down. So we'll see if they take that next step.
Maybe they'll get faster at it after all.
Maybe.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Proximity talks on Syria's political future resume today in Geneva with members of the opposition High Negotiations Committee. The meeting is aimed at ending more than 5 years of civil war. The key obstacle is the future of President Bashar al-Assad. The talks come amid growing concerns about renewed fighting that could jeopardize a 6-week-old cessation of hostilities. Another cause for tension has been the parliamentary elections held today in areas controlled by the government. The opposition has called the vote illegitimate and provocative. Regional analyst Heba El-Shazli of George Mason University in Virginia told VOA's Victor Beatty she is skeptical of the government's motive.
When you look at the tactics of this regime, you look at a regime that is definitely trying to stay in power, using every possible opportunity to delay, to gain time, every possible sort of diversion, if you will, in order to find its place and regain any kind of momentum it feels it's lost. This is not a regime or a person in Bashar al-Assad who's going to someday sort of wake up and smell the coffee and realize that the game is over and that he needs to, for his people's sake, to step down. He doesn't think that way.
The U.S. U.N. Ambassador Samantha Power on Tuesday said at the U.N., right now there are signs referring to the ceasefire that this is slipping and it's much more delicate environment for the U.N. envoy, Stefan de Mistura, to convene political talks. Is the ceasefire slipping, in your view?
It seems that way, unfortunately, because really who is going to be suffering? It's the people.
In Geneva, the second round of these so-called political transition talks is supposed to get underway this week. What are the prospects of success, in your view?
I think they'll take place. Now, success is how you define it. You know, when you come to negotiations, you come to the table, you have to have something called goodwill. There is not always goodwill at that table in Geneva, and I don't believe that the regime is a representative of what we consider to be goodwill.
Heba El-Shazli of George Mason University in Virginia. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Back in January, astronomers at the California Institute of Technology generated a lot of excitement when they said they found evidence of a giant planet they called Planet 9 in the far reaches of the solar system. Now, astrophysicists at Switzerland's University of Bern have created a computer model that provides additional insight into the mysterious Planet 9. They say their model allows them to assume that Planet 9 is an ice giant planet, smaller than Uranus and Neptune, and surrounded with a blanket of hydrogen and helium. They agree that the planet has 10 times the mass of Earth, that its radius is about 45,000 kilometers, and that it has a temperature of about minus 226 degrees Celsius. The scientists say that because its hot core is cooling, Planet 9 is as relatively warm as it is. If the core were completely cool, its temperature would be lower still. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter is in Manila amid tensions between the Philippines and China over Chinese militarization of features in the South China Sea. Traveling with the U.S. official is Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, and she joins us on the line. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Susan. Great to be with you.
Thank you. Is the secretary scheduled to discuss the South China Sea controversy with the Philippine officials there?
Of course, the South China Sea controversy is going to be one of the topics of discussion with Philippine officials. There are a couple of things on the billet that are going to take the priority for why the secretary is here, but each of those official things, which I'm sure we'll discuss in a minute, each of those things would not even be a major incident or a major top-line item if it wasn't for the advancement of Chinese aggression. I was speaking to a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, and he said, absolutely, the relationship with the U.S. and the Philippines has grown because of all of the Chinese aggression. We've seen reports of satellite imagery with the Spratly Islands, and the Spratly Islands are only about 160 kilometers away from the Philippines, parts of the Philippines. We've seen that imagery showing that there is a runway for jets or commercial airlines on what was once just a reef, but China has reclaimed that territory. We've seen evidence of them putting fighter jets on the Woody Islands, which are also in the South China Sea. So they've become more and more aggressive, and the Philippines is looking towards the United States to help to step in and to be able to be a counterweight to the Chinese moving closer and closer to their territory, what they believe is their territory.
You alluded to what the secretary will be up to. I take the bait. What's on his agenda?
Well, of course he wants to talk about this new agreement that was approved by the Filipino Constitutional Court that allows U.S. service members to come on some of the Filipino bases on a rotational basis. They're not going to be permanent troops by any means, but they will be rotating constantly on five different bases across the archipelago. One of those bases the secretary will be visiting, and that one is going to be at the point that is very close to the Spratly Islands that I was telling you about earlier, only about 160 kilometers away. So it will be very important, a senior defense official told me, for the United States to be there, not only to work with the Philippines, but to help with other countries in the region and to be able to serve as a deterrent message to China.
And meanwhile, there's that first installment of U.S. funding for improving naval capabilities in the Philippines.
Yes, that is going to be the first tranche of that that amount of money. It's over $400 million over 5 years. The first year is about $50 million, and about 80% of that, a senior defense official told me, is going to be going directly to the Philippines. They want the Philippines to not only be able to take care of their direct coast, but to see beyond the coast. And I think the underlying factor is going to be the presence of China, the aggressiveness of China. And it will be interesting as we look tomorrow, as we look at the conversations between the two defense officials and Secretary Carter and the president, it'll be interesting to see what they say about China and the South China Sea, because so far the United States, critics would say, the U.S. has not been very strong on what China has done in the South China Sea. They see China getting more and more aggressive, and the United States will say, well, we believe that there should not be militarization, and we believe that there should not be reclamation, but there's been no consequence if China continues to do what it does. And on the same vein, the United States is trying not to take sides. They've tried to be diplomatic in this while supporting our allies, saying, well, we want to be there in the Philippines, for example, to defend our ally, but they don't say from whom. They say we want to be in the South China Sea protecting the sea lanes, but they don't really say from whom. Even Secretary Carter today said that, well, of course, China is the one who's done the most militarization. But then he's also saying, but we're not directing this toward any one country. So I'm looking to the rhetoric tomorrow to see how Secretary Carter handles the South China Sea talks, to see if he is going to make China more accountable for its actions.
Well, thanks, Carla, for speaking with us today from Manila.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, a tip on surviving extinction. and Fifth Harmony's new single, Work From Home. The Earth is reportedly in the midst of its sixth mass extinction, a time when land and sea creatures are disappearing at rates up to 1,000 times faster than what would be considered the norm. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, the fossil record provides some clues to survival after the worst die-off in the planet's history.
252 million years ago, massive volcanic eruptions spewed billions of tons of carbon into the atmosphere, radically warming the climate and changing the chemistry of the ocean. Fully 95% of marine life and 70% of land creatures died. But to many scientists, it's the survivors that have stories to tell. One survivor that dominates the fossil records are therapsids, ancient relatives of mammals. Paleontologist Ken Angelczyk and colleagues at the Field Museum in Chicago did a microscopic analysis of a particular therapsid known as Lystrosaurus. Prior to the mass extinction, the animal lived a long life, 13 or 14 years. And based on the growth record preserved in its bones, Lystrosaurus was 2 meters long and about the size of a pygmy hippo.
When you go across the Permo-Triassic boundary, so you go through that extinction event and into the early Triassic period, the fall of the extinction, we find that most of our Lystrosaurus specimens are only 1 or 2 years old, and they seem to be growing rapidly throughout their sort of short lives.
As a survivor, Lystrosaurus bred much younger and spread to all areas of the globe to become the most abundant vertebrate after the third mass extinction. According to research published in Scientific Reports, rapid growth and a shorter lifespan increased its chances of survival by 40% in the unstable new environment. Angelczyk sees a modern version of this live-fast-die-young trend with the collapse of the Atlantic cod, which have been historically overfished, most recently in industrial-scale operations. Early records show cod lived between 10 and 15 years, with the oldest producing the most offspring.
Most of the individuals that you find in a given cod population now tend to be quite young, and they're being forced to breed basically as early in their life history as they possibly can. And so we see kind of this pattern where you have lots of young individuals that are sort of struggling to reproduce as early as possible, given the sort of disturbance of fishing, kind of similar to what you see with our Lystrosauruses, where you have lots of young individuals that we think are being forced to reproduce as early as they can.
Yet what separates our times from those 252 million years ago is that the extinction crisis today can be blamed largely on human activities that promote a warmer climate, polluted environments, invasive species, and habitat loss. Angelczyk says ancient fossil records offer a reference for action.
The more we learn about mass extinctions, including the work that we're doing, it'll help us better understand what might be happening in the world around us today, better plan for changes going forward, and hopefully also help to prevent some extinctions going forward in the modern world.
Angelczyk says as we move deeper into the sixth mass extinction, Lystrosaurus provides a valuable primer for survival. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
He comes around and he checks out everybody, makes sure everybody's all right, brings down supplies.
That's Todd Hoddle, who's homeless, talking about Brett Feldman, a physician assistant who delivers first-line medical care to people living on the streets of Allentown, Pennsylvania. It's one of 60 such programs in the United States.
The whole movement has been gaining steam.
Street medicine helps to cut costs, says Dr. Brian Nestor of the Lehigh Valley Health Network, Feldman's employer.
It seems to be keeping those crises down, so they won't have to come into the hospital, where it'll cost us in multiple times more.
Bridget Hammerstone is a recovering drug addict.
Someone like Brett is a blessing to me because he opens the door to allowing the light in for the first time in life, and it's real special.
Yeah. Very good.
I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
The musical group Fifth Harmony has a new album coming out with a new single, and to tell us all about it is Larry London of Border Crossings. Welcome, Larry.
Well, thank you, Susan. Yes, Fifth Harmony are coming out with their second album within 1 year.
Wow.
And that's kind of unusual, but they have been recording and writing and producing lots and lots of music. So the first album, Reflections, came out last year. And now we're waiting for the second album. May 27th is the release date. The new album is called 727, which, interestingly enough, is the day they were discovered on The X Factor.
Oh, that's neat.
So that's why they decided to call the new album 727. They say this album is going to be a little different for their fans than the first album was, in that it will be more R&B, more hip-hop oriented. They've worked with some hip-hop producers on the new album. The girls keep getting asked the same question, are you breaking up, are you breaking up? And at first they said, well, one day we will. And now, you know, they're saying less of that. They're saying, no, our plan is to stay together, you know, and ride this out. So we'll see how it all works out for Fifth Harmony. But very talented young ladies, and I have had them on my show several times.
Oh.
They're a pleasure to talk to. They're a lot of fun. And in a day and age where, you know, it seems that female artists reign supreme, they've got a lot going for them. They've got a huge fan group, which is called the Harmonizers. That's what their fan club's known as. And I think the new album will be good, 727. You don't gotta go to work, but you gotta go to work. You don't gotta go to work. And my body do the work.
You're going to place this one new single anywhere, the Work From Home?
Yeah, you know, the interesting story behind the new single for them was that they were going to call it Work. But they decided that Rihanna's song Work would confuse the fans and confuse the audience because Rihanna's Work has been number one now for 6 weeks.
Right.
And so they changed the name of it to Work From Home. So it'd give it a
I like it. I think it's cute.
Yeah, and I think we should do more of that.
Okay. Well, Larry, remind our listeners where they can find you.
Well, thank you, Susan. Fifth Harmony can be found around the world, and Larry London can be found on Border Crossings. You can find me several places. You can go to the voanews.com website and search Larry London. It'll probably show you where I am. The name of the show is Border Crossings, or you can go to facebook.com/VOA Larry London.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you.
You can find us at VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
22 years ago, one of the worst crimes against humanity in the 20th century occurred in Rwanda. More than 800,000 men, women, and children were systematically murdered during 100 days of unspeakable violence. The killings, deliberately planned and sanctioned by the ethnic Hutu-led government, began in earnest April 7, 1994, the day after a plane carrying the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi was shot down, killing both leaders. Ethnic Tutsi citizens, a minority in the country's population of about 7 million, were specifically targeted. However, politically moderate Hutu and ethnic Twa sympathizers were also killed. "We honor not just the victims," said President Barack Obama in a written statement delivered on the commemoration of the 22nd anniversary of the genocide, "but also those who risked their lives to save others, as well as the survivors who carry the memories of these atrocities." "It is important to mark these occasions in order to remind ourselves," said President Obama, "of our common humanity and shared commitment to protecting civilians and ensuring that mass atrocities of this magnitude never happen again." Over the last two decades, Rwanda has made progress in moving beyond these horrible crimes and in building a more peaceful and prosperous future for its citizens. The United States remains deeply committed to preventing the horror of mass atrocities and genocide from occurring again, and to continuing to work with the people of Rwanda and the international community to finish the task of bringing those responsible for those heinous acts to justice.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.